and welcome to On Repeat.
With me, Beth.
And me, Susanna.
This is the frank and honest podcast about living with obsessive compulsive disorder.
Disclaimer, we're not mental health professionals. Please visit OCD Action and OCD UK for services that can help and support you.
We're very excited to share with you our conversation with the lovely Olivia Sergai. Olivia is a mental health advocate and
wonderful Instagrammer.
She runs an account all about her own experiences living with OCD.
And she's very frank and she's very honest, which is why she's on a frank and honest podcast.
We loved chatting to her, didn't we? Well, I did. Did you?
Yes, I did, yeah.
Oh, she was great. She was great. And just like her Instagram is, just so, repeats it, frank and honest.
So frank and honest.
She's just bloody frank and honest, isn't she, as a person? No, but one of the things that we love that Olivia does is her Instagram lives or her Instagram videos, where she kind of talks you through moment to moment her experience.
She is also a fellow podcaster.
Which we will be linking in the show notes below. It's a wonderful podcast and it's called Don't Bottle That Shit Up. And I completely agree with her.
Yeah.
Don't bottle it up.
Cool.
Are you ready?
Hope you enjoy it.
Hope you enjoy it.
Have fun. See you on the other side. We chatted for quite a long time. Hopefully we've got this to a reasonable length for you to listen to and that you will enjoy it.
It's going to take me ages to edit, isn't it?
Yeah, it's going to take you ages. Probably months.
Lucky it's lockdown, isn't it? We kind of want to start by asking you what led you to starting to speak out about your mental health, because you're amazing on Instagram and you started a podcast as well, and you're just putting everything out there, like some of your Instagram lives where you talk us through your rituals and stuff. What made you start doing that?
Thank you, that's so nice of you. I'm not really sure, to be honest. I've been struggling with it since I was like 14. It used to really, really annoy me seeing stuff on social media, like Instagram, like, oh, I'm so OCD today. Like, some influencers even say it. Like, I've had to call out a few on their comment section, like, oh, this photo was taken on Sunday and I'm posting it after the one that was taken on Tuesday. It's really messing with my OCD or something. And I was like, just to let you know, this is kind of offensive. And I think that was one of the things that made me start doing that. I think I also kept seeing loads of stuff about OCD recovery, and I don't think that that's something that is essentially possible with a lot of people, and I just think it's, you know, more about managing it and living alongside it. That's kind of why my handle is Living With It.
I agree, because sometimes when I see that OCD recovery stuff, like, I guess it can be great for some people, but do you find that it makes you kind of go, well, why haven't I recovered from it? Or I kind of put pressure on myself that I need to have recovered. And maybe,
yeah,
it's about managing it.
Mm. I always think what they're talking about is something I've tried, so why is it not tried for me if they're now recovered from it? It makes you feel like,
it's like a blame the victim type of situation.
Yeah.
And it's like, well, like a lot of people can't recover from it. Like,
yeah,
mine is very much, you know, a lifelong condition. And I think if a therapist that's trained for 12 years is telling me that, mm-hmm, they're more qualified to tell me that than some account online being like,
yeah,
recovery.
Yeah. Love the power. But like, and obviously that's not to say that for some people it is possible and that's amazing, but I completely agree. It can also be possible to live a normal life, but also be managing your OCD alongside it. And that maybe, rather than putting the pressure on yourself to recover.
Yeah.
How do you feel since doing it? Like, what's the outcome been for yourself?
I think I'm a lot more compassionate towards myself. Mm-hmm. Like, it's something that I've been working on. I think, you know, as sufferers of OCD, you do live alongside this, you know, really critical voice where it tells you that you're not good enough, you're horrible, you're this and that. Oh, you're not good enough to challenge your behaviours.
Yeah.
Which doesn't help, you get it externally as well. And my therapist always says, like, don't, like, stop beating the crap out of yourself. Like, how would you talk to your friend Jess, who's also got OCD, he's been on my podcast. And that really changed my perspective on it. And I think because I'm putting it out online now, and I get people messaging me like, oh, I've had a really bad day, I'm having to give out advice a lot more than I normally would. Mm-hmm. And when I'm feeling bad, and when I'm feeling bad about myself for doing my behaviors, it helps me to think of what I've said to other people, because I'm like, you know, it's about that objective judgment, not your, you know,
yes,
separating from your critical voice that's always going to be like, well, you've not done it well enough, you're not doing this.
Yeah. And I suppose it's quite empowering to be giving advice to someone else that you could then take on for yourself.
Yeah, it's really, really nice. Me and my friend Ellie talk about it in this episode of my podcast I just recorded. Yeah. It's like, she said she read a dedication of a book that basically said to all my clients that paid to teach me, because she's learning to be a psychotherapist. And I think it's like a nice saying.
If I think to myself, well, would you want Susanna to continue doing that ritual, which isn't helping her, and blah, 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 blah. Mm. So then I think to myself, okay, well, I would tell Susanna to try and challenge it. So therefore I need to challenge it. Kind of a practice what I preach thing, I find.
Yeah, I definitely need to employ that aspect. But when you're giving advice to a friend, you're like, it's fine, no one's going to die. And then you're there like,
yeah.
It's
so different.
I find it, particularly with the pandemic, I feel like more of my friends have started showing signs of anxiety. And just also over the years, because obviously I've had OCD and anxiety and things since I was like 9, and I've gone through all that kind of like, oh, finding out what it is, being put on medication, like all of that years and years ago. It's weird when my friends now are like, oh, I've just been put on meds, or they have like a panic attack, and they're like, oh, I've just had a panic attack for the first time. And I'll sit with, like, we sat with them, and they'll be like, oh, I can't do it. I'll be like, look, it's fine, okay? We both know it's fine. I'm like, why can't I tell myself this?
That's so interesting.
I can sit with you. And I always say to my friends, don't feel like you can't come to me with your issues, because I know I can't handle my own, so I might not look like a very good person to come to, but I actually find it so much easier to kind of deal with someone else's issues, because I can be like, aha, I feel like the one who's logical in this moment.
That's great. And you can apply logic when when it's not your obsession. You actually said something in your very first episode that I just recently listened to, like, about the pandemic and how I kind of loved it. You were like, people with anxiety disorders almost were like better prepared for the pandemic.
Because our brains are always like, you're gonna die, and we're just like, oh. I think we're better equipped to handle anxiety and feelings of stress because we've had it for so long.
Yeah.
Like, some of my friends now, like, apparently 27% of students develop a mental health disorder when they're at uni or condition. Mm. And some of my friends now are like kind of almost edging, like verging on that. And it does feel like I'm very lucky to have had it from a young age, so that I've kind of, you know, now at 20, I've got all these tools where I can, you know, I know how to cope with it. Yeah. Whereas some people are just going through that now, which is, it's a turbulent time of your life as it is, like, without chucking in a new mental health condition in there.
Yeah.
One of my friends, like, he's so laid back, he's basically lying down. And now the pandemic's happening, he started having panic attacks, and he's so scared of giving people coronavirus, and he's constantly determined that he must have it and he's going to give it to people. And I just think it's just weird seeing someone who's always been so relaxed, and now that this situation is happening all around them. When we were talking to Bryony Gordon, actually, this kind of came into my head, because she was talking about how a lot of her OCD was kind of originally triggered by the AIDS campaign adverts. And I'd already thought of it before she said that, but then, like, the adverts that you see now on TV, the, like, government campaigns,
and there's one where you can see the germs.
Like, how many children are gonna see that, be triggered, and like OCD tendencies are gonna
I worry about children who might be susceptible slightly.
It's weird, isn't it, because it's like this balance of, you know, you've got to scare people into, you know, looking after themselves and stuff, but then it's also this, well, you know, you shouldn't really be using scare, like, fear as a tactic. Especially with, you know, the younger generations are much more susceptible to anxiety and depression and mental health disorders. And it is this weird line that, I don't know, sometimes they cross and sometimes it's like, are they crossing it?
It's
this grey area.
Do you have a defining moment where your OCD, you feel like your OCD was triggered for the first time? As you, did you say you were 14 when it happened, or?
Yeah, I was 14 when I got like actually diagnosed, but I think I've had like a lot of tendencies since I was a child. And I think one point that really stands out for me is when basically I had this teacher, and for some reason this just really, really triggered me. And I was looking at her and I just felt a bit picked on. And I was looking at her, so I was like, okay, well, she's not going to pick at me if I'm literally looking at her and staring at her. And then she was like, Olivia, listen. And like in front of the whole class. And for some reason that just like, it's that humiliation that just made me feel like this horrible person, and like, oh my god, everyone's looking at me, oh, this is so horrible, like, get it, like, oh, and you know when you're a kid and you don't know how to handle these emotions, you don't know what they are. Yeah. And they feel so scary. And after then I just got, just, it's really weird because it's just one small thing that happened to me, but after then I just got hyper anxious about literally everything. Mm-hmm. And I didn't want any attention to be on me. And I started getting anxious, not even just about attention. I started getting anxious about, I couldn't eat certain things because I thought I was going to choke. And that was when the whole like death thing came to play as well, because I think because that horrible like influx of humiliation, of guilt, of anxiety and everything, it does feel very, not morbid, but it feels very like, if you haven't had a sort of influx of feelings like that before, it does feel like, whoa,
very intense.
Is this,
yeah,
and very, very intense, and it does sort of leave you thinking about extreme things. Mm-hmm. And because your feelings are so extreme, and I think that is what triggered my tendencies from a young age. I mean, they went away after a while, but then obviously they came back when I was like 14, as like actual clinical OCD.
It's interesting talking to someone else who's had a OCD that's affected their eating, because I don't know if I've ever really kind of come across someone else with that, because my OCD, it originally, I mean, it was all to do because I have a phobia of sick, so it was
okay,
like,
yeah,
it was like, okay, well, just don't eat, and then, you know, that's that problem solved.
Which is similar, I guess, for you, but just about choking.
Yeah,
yours was like, well, if I don't eat certain things.
But my my, it particularly latched on to meat. And I actually haven't eaten meat since. I'm, you know, being vegetarian for over 10 years, because I was so scared that that meat was never going to be cooked properly, and therefore that I would become ill from it. Yeah, OCD and emetophobia are really, they're very close anyway, even if you don't have both, even if you do just have emetophobia, because it's all to do with germs, you might
end up doing some behaviours.
Yeah, like you have different behaviours, but you just don't have the intrusive thoughts part of it. It's so they are very close anyway, so I'm not surprised how many people do have both.
How did your obsession about choking, how did it affect you?
I don't really know, because it was so long ago and I was really young. It sort of went away as soon as my OCD tendencies went away. So my teacher actually moved away, that one teacher that was like, that humiliated me.
Right.
And after then they sort of just went. It's really, really weird.
That's amazing. It's almost like they were interlinked with that teacher.
Yeah.
Wow.
Because I think it was because of that incident that did make me really, really anxious. That was then like a really anxious like presence in my life, if that makes sense, like you link that. And then when she moved away, like it kind of all calmed down a lot. But yeah, I wouldn't eat like chips and stuff, because you know they're like really stodgy and things like that. And my headmistress came over to my like lunch table once at school, because I went to a really small primary school, and she was like, Olivia, why aren't you eating your chips? And I was just like sheepishly like, I don't like chips. And she was like, I've never met a kid that doesn't like
chips.
Yeah.
So it's a classic example of OCD stopping you from, you know, something really lovely, like eating chips, which is like a pleasure that you should be having as a child. And OCD is stopping you.
How does it kind of manifest itself now? Because now you're, you know, 20 and you're at university. Your life has changed quite a lot since you were a primary schooler. Yes.
I'm not really sure. Mine, so when I was 14, it started massively centering around death. And
that's the same for me when I was 14. That's weird.
That is so weird. Maybe it's because, you know, you start looking at, you know, later life. I don't even like know what triggered the whole like obsession with death thing, but I just started getting really freaked out by the idea that someone could die and then someone could die and it would be my fault.
Mm-hmm.
And this whole, I think this actually started from quite a young age though as well, like when I'm thinking about it now, because I remember when I was younger, I used to like lie in bed at night and I'd have to like pray every night, otherwise someone was going to die.
I think we've both had that thing.
It's so weird, isn't it? It would always be the same thing, like, everyone I love, wake up happy and healthy.
Did you used to get this with wishes or like, you know, a wish on a birthday cake, or like if you saw a shooting star or something, like you would end up being like, even if you'd wish something selfish, like, oh, I hope I get a horse. I'm just trying to think of an example. But also, I would also have to go, and also everybody be happy and healthy and have happy and healthy lives and everyone be okay. Like every single thing.
I literally had that every single time I had to make a wish. It's really interesting how we can like look back at our younger selves, and even from before you'd like have been diagnosed with OCD, and you can look back and think, oh,
that's what that
actually
was.
Maybe that was what that was. Mm. So it's interesting that you can look back now and think, oh, well, yeah, I probably had tendencies, like I can see it there and I can see it manifesting itself there. And
So you went into kind of a death obsession at around 14. Yeah.
I just started getting really, really freaked out by that. And then it was a whole like, it was that overprotective voice kicked in again. So it kind of manifested in sort of similar to panic disorder, when like I wouldn't leave the house because I was scared of having a panic attack. I would never go to the gym. I wouldn't do things by myself. Like, I'd go to the gym with my friend. So if I had a panic attack, I'd be safe.
Yeah.
And then I sort of got out of that a bit by just, so I had therapy for that.
Okay. And what sort of thing did, because I heard about you, I heard you talking about this on your first episode. What I found it really helpful myself to listen to the kind of stuff you did in therapy. Do you mind sharing that with us, what you kind of did?
I think, so it's called ACT, Acceptance and Commitment Therapy, and I think it's a branch of CBT.
Okay.
And it's basically all about learning how to sit with your feelings and recognizing that they're not things to be scared of. Which obviously this is like an ongoing thing you do throughout your life. Like, I'm still having to use these techniques now. But it was really, really helpful because it kind of made me realize. So I think the first thing is like diffusion. And then it's like, which is like diffusing from your intrusive thoughts, realizing that they're not threats. They're just like stories that go through your mind. Mm. And then the second bit is like, something to do with sitting with your feelings, and the third bit is about living like a meaningful life with this like ability to sit with your feelings and stuff. And I think the sitting with your feelings part really, really helped me realize that, you know, if I were to have a panic attack, it wouldn't be the end of the world. I wasn't going to die from it because I hadn't died before. But my therapist always like kind of says this to me whenever I like sort of get in touch with him again because I'm having a bit of a wobble. He's always like, you've proven time and time again that you can cope. You know, you've gone to New Zealand and Australia and you've been able to handle your anxiety, like, but you're still like, you're still latching onto these thoughts of not being able to cope and stuff. And that is kind of like, he's kind of helped me in that way of sort of, you know, now when I'm really stressed that I won't be able to cope with something, I don't do as much of the, I did this one technique with him where I would say, I can't cope, 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 and just keep repeating it for like 2 minutes as fast as you can and recognize that they were just sounds. And I think now it's more about, for me, recognizing that there's no truth in that, not about recognizing that it's just a story. I think now it's about recognizing that it's not
true.
A true story.
Yeah.
Even though, you know, it's a bit, I don't know, it's a bit counterproductive because therapy is meant to be, you know, you recognize that they're stories, it doesn't matter if they're true or false. But
it goes back to what you were saying about feeling like you can't handle that negative emotion. So feeling like you might go, I'm sure I would get through it, but I can't cope with feeling that way. I don't want to feel that anxiety. I don't want to feel that fear. And sorry, my email, I just got an email. I don't know how to turn off the sound of the, well, anyway, and so on technical. But what was I saying? Oh, yeah, it goes back to not believing that you can cope with that uncomfortable feeling. And actually, that's why I'm, you know, what you were just saying you did in therapy about accepting your feelings and not constantly trying to escape them or stop yourself from feeling, you know, sad, lonely, scared, anxious. These are all normal feelings that we're all going to feel in our lives, throughout our lives.
Yeah, exactly. There's this really good book, and I literally shout about this from the rooftops literally every single opportunity I get. It's called The Happiness Trap Pocketbook.
Okay.
And it's by Russ Harris, and it basically is all about that in like the second section of it. And it kind of is about ACT and like CBT, and it's really, really interesting. And I've been using the sort of techniques it says recently when I'm feeling anxious. It's basically just talks about how we label our emotions as good and bad, when no emotion is good and bad in itself. It's just, you know, chemical changes going through your body. It's got no, you know, there's no point putting a judgment on a feeling, if that makes sense. But we do it as a society.
Yeah, we're fed this idea of like perfectism. Is that the word?
Perfectionism.
We're fed this
I really wasn't sure what you were trying to say there.
No, we're fed this idea of like happiness, aren't we, that we should always feel. And I think for me, often the thing that triggers my anxiety or ACD is feeling like I'm in some way not as happy and content as I should be, or, you know, I need to achieve this in order to have the life you're meant to have, or the happiness that you're meant to feel, which is completely unnatural. Like, we're not meant to be happy all the time, because you can't be.
There's this quote in that book that basically says like a full life contains a full range of emotions.
I love that.
I think that is like encapsulates the whole thing.
Actually really enjoy listening to songs that are sad and like watching sad films.
It can be really cathartic, can't it?
I enjoy a good cry.
Yeah, good cry. There's nothing like it.
Obviously, you are really brave and you talk very openly on your Instagram about your rituals, and you do exposures and things, like you did a day in the life, and you're like, oh well, I'm gonna choose what to wear now, my OCD is telling me not to wear this, so I'm gonna wear it. And I was just wondering whether doing that kind of publicly on a forum where people can see you doing it, is that helpful, knowing that people are going to watch you?
I think it does hold me accountable. I think that day I was probably like, oh, like whatever, I'll just wear it. I'll just wear what Mr. OCD is telling me to wear, you know, happy OCD, happy life. Isn't the case, obviously,
but it can feel it. It's that instant gratification, isn't it? It's that it's easier to just give in to what it's telling me to do right now, because then this anxiety will go away quicker than if I fight it and then it doesn't control me anymore.
And I think, you know, putting it out there publicly does kind of make me hold myself more accountable for doing my behaviors. But as much as, you know, there's a fine line, as much as I want to hold myself accountable, I also want to be nice to myself. So it's that line of like, you know, self-compassion through, you know, being nice to yourself, but also, you know,
challenging yourself
you know, these behaviors that aren't good for us, whether that be like laziness, OCD behaviors, procrastination, like whatever it may be. It's all about finding a balance.
It's also, I found that kind of when I was watching that really resonated with me, because my OCD at the moment is really focused on what I can and can't wear. It like tells me completely and utterly, okay, well, you can wear this, you can't wear it. I'm like, I think because it's that the fear of change, isn't it, that kind of OCD kind of really embeds itself in. And wearing something new or something for the first time, it's like a physical representation of change. And I think, when I was watching that, I was like, oh, wow, someone else who has that thing. I think it's always, and this is why, like, you doing what you do is great, because it's so nice for people with OCD to find other people who have the same fears and the same
compulsions.
You kind of almost feel like, oh, I'm not alone. It makes you feel like you're not alone, because someone else really is going through
the
what
same
you're
thing.
Going through.
Yeah, exactly. That's kind of why I put that video out there. Like, it's kind of a twofold thing why I, you know, have my Instagram channel, and it's to educate and destigmatize, but also to make sufferers feel better. Not sufferers, but people who live alongside OCD, make them feel less alone. Because I know when I first got diagnosed, I read the statistic that 1% of people had it, and I just felt so isolated and like I'd never meet anyone with it. I think that percentage is wrong probably, because I've met loads of people.
Yeah, but I felt exactly the same when I was first told I had it, which I was really young, but I didn't think anyone else, I didn't think there was anyone else in the world with it. You didn't feel like there was.
It's so weird, isn't it? It feels like you've got this like specific medical condition, like, oh, there's something wrong with my pinky finger, it's got this and that wrong with it. Like, you feel like, oh my God, no one else has got this. But
yeah. And like, I have to say, that is one amazing thing about social media, is the fact that people like us, but and you, like, we're able to, people will find your Instagram and go, like you did, oh my god, she's doing exactly what I have to do every morning. And I think it's really cool to have somebody like showing the reality of having OCD on Instagram. Yeah. So amazing.
Because
well done.
It's looked at through this like rose tinted lens where people are like, I've recovered, I'm doing this and that.
Mm-hmm.
And you know, I just did want to broadcast some of the, you know, kind of uglier truths and sides of it, you know.
Yeah.
Yeah, because there's not going to be a day where my OCD doesn't tell me things.
No.
Most of the kind of
live a full life.
Yeah.
Most of the kind of popular, large social media followed accounts to do with OCD are usually the people who are like to do with everything being really neat and tidy and kind of the stereotypical. Oh, yeah. They were talking about OCD on our local area's BBC radio station, and there was a woman on there who had like an account online. It was called like the Queen of Clean or something, and I was so
alarm bells are going
so
off.
Angry at this program, as they were talking about was people who like everything neat and tidy, and people were ringing in and being like, they were talking about all about OCD, and it was a program about OCD, and I got so fed up I rang in and I was like, look, I'm at university at the moment. This was a couple of years ago. I was like, I'm at university, it takes me 8 hours to leave my room in the morning. And this guy was like, right, okay.
they don't know what to say, do they? It's so funny.
He was live on air, so he was like, oh, I'm so sorry to hear this. And I was like, yeah, okay,
this
well, now I'm
going
to tell you what OCD actually is.
Oh, like, well done.
It's not just a kind of quirky little, you know, oh, look.
Cutesy.
At,
yeah.
It's not a personality trait. It's not like an actual debilitating thing.
Or it's people who should be, you know.
And that makes me think about exams, because I know with education in general, there's a real thing of, if people think that OCD is about being tidy and wanting to get things right, it would be easy to interpret that as thinking that that's a good thing for education and a good thing for exams, because that means that you make sure your essay is perfect. That means that you make sure all your answers are correct. And it's the opposite, right? If you have OCD and you're doing exams, it generally gets in the way. It doesn't help.
Yeah, of course it does.
You know, you're getting bloody intrusive thoughts about people getting murdered or dying or whatever your intrusive thoughts are when you're writing an essay. Like, obviously, you're not going to be able to concentrate as well.
Yeah.
And, well done for ringing them up.
Yeah, well done, Susanna.
How are you finding being at uni, but, you know, you're not at uni, you're at home. And so you're kind of, you're not in that working environment. Does that make the OCD more impactful on your
It's really hard to say because I only like had first year, like, and didn't have a full first year.
Oh, that's so annoying.
Of like experiencing studying at uni.
Yeah.
Well, obviously in at the start of this semester, not this semester, last semester, we were going to the library and stuff, and I do think it does help going to the library, getting out.
Yeah.
And I think it's probably harder studying from home, actually. For me, anyways, I can't separate from my, you know, from my work and then my bed to sleep in, if that makes sense.
Yeah.
Like I get a few like stresses, like trying to sleep and stuff, which is kind of annoying. I just start thinking about everything I have to do the next day. Whereas if I go to the library and do stuff, I don't really get that. But also, like, the main impact of it all is more not to do on with, like, it's impacted my motivation massively. Like, if you can't, if you can hardly do anything, you've got hardly anything to look forward to, why the hell are you going to want to work?
So
I'm trying to work on that at the moment. I think, you know, anxiety and shame can be used to our own advantage in the realm of work and productivity. Like, I message my best friend most days, like, this is what I'm going to do today, and it makes me do it, because then if I don't do it, I have to, like, be like, I didn't do it. But yeah, I think it's difficult finding that motivation at home, and then it does leave you in that sort of cycle of the toxic productivity mindset of, like, I'm not good enough, I'm a bad person because I can't do this and that, because I'm struggling with anxiety and I can't.
I know that when I was at university, if I wanted to do any work, I had to be out of the house. It's really? Just like emotional
separation. Like,
yeah, you just can't.
Were you able to have less rituals if you were outside the house?
Yeah, so if I think my mostly often manifests, well, it manifests more in places that I spend more time, because obviously it has more time to attach to things. So yeah. If I'm out and about, and I'm in a public place, so then I feel kind of more self-conscious. I'm like, people can see me. I can't just, you know, stand here tapping things. I was able to work far better if I was in the university environment than I was if I was in, like, I never worked in my room at university. Yeah. I used to spend, the amount of time that I would spend in my room at university was how much time it would take me to leave my room. So it was kind of, I was there for as minimal amount of possible. So I really feel for students at the moment who aren't able to go out, and also just to have the social aspect of university. I mean, I hope
that anybody in that situation who is struggling with a mental health disorder has the support and knows that there is support out there and can. Has your uni been supportive in terms of OCD? Have you been honest with them about it and asked for any kind of support?
Yeah, Leeds have actually been amazing with me. Basically, because I got diagnosed when I was 14, and then basically I had this breakdown when I was 18, and it just really, really turmoiled. And I talk about it a bit in my first podcast. It's just like, it just stopped me eating. It stopped me being able to function properly. And basically my school didn't really understand what it was. And so I've got loads of these letters from my psychiatrist writing to my school being like, this is what it is, blah, blah, blah. Like, so I kind of already had all of the, you know, evidence that they need for, because they ask for, like, how does it impact you? How does it, blah, 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 all from doctors. And I already had all of that from when I was really, really bad during my A-levels. And like, I think I got like, special circumstances or whatever from the examining board from it.
That's good.
And then, yeah, so I just submitted all the evidence when I first started university, because there was this option, like do you have a disability, like, do you want to register at disability services? And I know one of my friends was like, no, I don't want to do that because I don't want it to affect me. And I was like, the thing is that if you do it, you then have, you know, these systems in place that if it does affect you, you can go to, and it's like a touch point. But no, they've been really, really good. If I want an extension on an essay or whatever, I can literally just email in. You have to fill out a form for an extension, so I fill that out, and then they say, like, evidence, blah, 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 and I just put in all evidence with disability services, and it's really, really easy for me to get extensions when I need them because of my OCD, which is really, really good.
And I think most universities have this, and I think it's really good for people to know that these are there.
That it exists.
They should tap into
them,
because I know that I wouldn't have been able to complete my degree without them. They're obviously helping you as well. I just think they're really important. And also, the more people who kind of do start to come forward and say, yes, this is the situation that I'm in, and I this is why I need help, it's because of OCD, it will make these disability services start to realise that, okay, this is actually a genuine thing that we do need to think about. Because I know when I filled in forms, because I have depression as well, they'd always pick up on that, and they'd be like, oh, that must be the reason you're having extensions. And I'd be like, no, the reason I'm having extensions is because of the OCD
not the depression.
So it was, I think, the more people that kind of
start to understand that OCD is a debilitating Disorder.
Disorder.
Yeah. Yeah, 100%.
This is something we want.
This is definitely yo-yoing backwards, but this was the thing that I voice noted you about earlier because I got so excited about it. I don't know why. But it's because I always, like I was saying to you, like it's always been a running joke in my family, like tantrums, like doing a Beth is having a massive tantrum. And that's because when I was a toddler, I had these like insane...
She'd either be laughing or screaming.
Yeah, it was like very extreme emotion. And but the tantrums were apparently major. And you mentioned in your podcast that you had a similar thing and you think it might be related to your like having anxiety. Can you... Is that, do you think it is related?
Yeah, I think mine are massively related. I said are.
I know, I want to make it really clear. I don't have tantrums anymore in front of people.
Not that people know of. When I did have tantrums, it was very much like from fear rather than anger.
Yeah.
I would be really scared and I didn't know how to handle these emotions. And then when you're like, I don't even know, like as a child, you just don't have anywhere for these emotions to go or any outlets to, you know, use to, you know, realize what this is and stuff. And I remember having one tantrum when I was on holiday and I slammed this door and a nail fell out of it. And now it's like a family joke. Like, and my dad was like recording it. And it's like this joke, like they're going to play it at my wedding and all this. And like, I do think it is like a fine line. Like I was definitely a little shit as a kid.
Yeah.
But there was also this aspect of it, which was like, okay, like I was having tantrums because I was really scared that like basically every time that my family would be like out of sight or whatever, I would get, even when I was like 8 or 9, which, you know, if you want to like, you know, you've got to stay in the car when your brothers are getting dropped off at school or whatever. Like, it's a normal thing. It's not like they were leaving me for like hours and hours. They were leaving me for like 30 seconds. And, but I was just convinced that they weren't going to come back for some reason. I think it's because the Maddie McCann stuff started when I was quite an impressionable age.
Yes. Yeah.
And I think that massively affected my anxiety in terms of that as a child. And I think ever since then, I just got really like prangy and anxious about all things like that. And then you know, you don't have anywhere for this anxiety to go, and then you get angry. And
the whole not understanding the emotion that you're experiencing or not knowing how to,
you just don't have the vocabulary when you're younger to, and you don't it's something you've never, it's not something that's taught. You don't get taught it in school.
Exactly.
That this is
it
something
needs to be,
you know. I was probably like, I don't know, I maybe like 8 years into having panic attacks before the that was a thing that people started talking about, and panic attacks were kind of written about, or, you know, on social media, or people would be like, oh, this is what, you know, there are lots of different types. But I was something like, oh my word.
Yeah, let's talk about panic attacks, because I know. Hey,
oh,
guys,
yay! Woo!
Let's talk about panic attacks.
I do get them. I don't get them as much as I used to. When I was like 14, I would literally go to school, have a panic attack, like come home, have a panic attack. Like I get them all the time. I'd have at least like 9 a week. And like that was when it got really bad, and that's when I was like, okay, I need to see a therapist. And then obviously like they gradually decreased, and I think because I did all that work when I was so like young, when I was like 14 15, now I don't get them as much. Because I know that I do have systems in place for when I feel like I can't cope. When I was 18, the anxiety levels were at an all-time high, and they did massively come back then as well. But now I don't really get that many. I think I probably get like a couple a year, which is mental to me because I used to struggle massively with them. But they're always about the same old fears. It's like when I get run down, or when I get it's mainly when I get run down that, and then I do something and then I just trigger myself, and it just starts this whole influx of anxiety. Like nothing that used to really stress me out stresses me out anymore, really. Like I used to get stressed about being in big crowds, like talking in public. I used to get stressed about being in the room for like assembly at school. And then like by my last year at school, I was like standing on the stage like talking to people. But now like my fears have kind of changed a bit, and it's, I don't really know what start my panic attacks. It is that fear of I can't cope. Yeah. And I think I do quite a good job of silencing it and, you know, distancing myself from it a lot of the time. But sometimes when I'm really run down and when, you know, in a global climate like now, everything feels like, you know, it's very final.
Yeah.
I do feel more susceptible to panic attacks at the moment.
Mm.
I had a really anxious day yesterday, but I just slowed down and focused on my breathing and I was okay. But, you know, it could have gone the other way.
I'm worried about the period when hopefully things start to reopen again and we start to be integrated back into society and the kind of anxiety that that's going to come.
Yeah.
Because a lot of my panic attacks happen when I'm in places where I feel trapped or there are people. So, yeah, I think it is going to, it probably going to trigger, you know, panic attacks.
People's social anxiety.
Yeah.
And so
yeah,
I remember, sorry. Ignore me.
Oh, I was just going to say, when I first, I came out of, I isolated in Leeds for a bit, because I was like contacted by Test and Trace, and then as soon as I went out afterwards I was like suddenly so self-conscious. I was like, oh my god, no one look at me. And then I felt like I was 14 again. And I do fear for like when things massively start up again, people are gonna start struggling, even people that haven't struggled with it before. My mum was literally saying when we were watching TV the other day, like, oh gosh, I don't know how I'll feel like getting close to people again.
I think it's going to be a challenge for even those without any kind of anxiety disorders, but hopefully maybe it's something that needs to be like talked about before it happens. There needs to be some coping strategies for people,
maybe some more funding.
That
would be
nice.
We need
some more fucking money. But so what helps you with your panic attacks when they're, you know, what are your coping mechanisms for them?
So it's really weird because I so nearly had one yesterday. I think it's, I felt really, really anxious and I felt like I was going to have a panic attack. I took myself out of the house, turned my phone off. Well, I spoke to my friend Jess and then I turned my phone off.
Jess sounds like a legend, by the way.
Oh my God, she is literally a living legend.
Like, shout out to Jess!
shout out to Jess!
And then I sort of, my therapist basically, when I spoke to him in the first lockdown, he basically said that I need to do more mindfulness. Tell me something I don't know. I always need to do more mindfulness. But he was like, he just gave me like loads of different examples of mindfulness that he does. And he said, yeah, you don't have to constantly, you know, be focusing on your breath. You could go for a walk and not let yourself think about, you know, you could just concentrate on the leaves and the trees, what colors they are, stare at a leaf for a minute or so. And that's why art can be so helpful for anxiety. And even things like drama and, you know, the subject, not art, drama, theatrics and all of that sort of stuff can be so helpful because you are forced to concentrate on one thing.
Mm-hmm.
And but yeah, when I feel like I'm getting really panicky, I take myself out on a walk, and I sometimes leave my phone at home, so there's one less thing to stress about, because I think there is a massive link to, you know, oh, anyone can contact me at any time, like I have to be accessible.
You're really struggling with that.
Yeah, that is actually where my it's interesting you say that. That is where my OCD is probably most like focused at the moment for me, is my phone. And I think it's because that's my connection to all of my outside life. Mm-hmm. And I've had to like really challenge it. And because I realized that whenever I felt the anxiety or like I had an intrusive thought, I would immediately go on WhatsApp and message, someone on WhatsApp. There'll be a friend somewhere that will reassure me or say something helpful, or like you say, or a distraction. And you end up, you don't realise how long you end up then just sitting there, either in one conversation with someone, probably doing a compulsion without even realising it, because it's so sneaky and you think, oh no, I'm just chatting to my friend. But actually, I think it did turn into a compulsion. So I've had to delete WhatsApp. And a little bit like you said, I mean, I'm not going to delete it forever because you kind of need it, which is really annoying.
Oh, of course, yeah.
And also, I think it will be a good challenge for, it will be a challenge for me to have it there, and I'll have to, the next step will have to be,
I'm now just taking you all through the therapy I'm doing with myself. So my next step's going to be to re-download WhatsApp in a few days and then not allow myself on it, which will be harder than it just not being.
We're definitely, like, as a society and as a generation, we're all addicted to our phones.
Completely.
Even parents. Like, my mum is on her phone all the time. I'm on my phone all the time. Like, it's a joke. And even when I'm, like, trying to write an essay, I have to turn my phone off and put it under my bed cover so I don't, you know, think about it.
I have dropped my phone down the back of my bed so that I can't get to it because it's such a ball ache to go underneath the bed and find it. I've done that before. Oh, I have. And, like, it is because I think, like you say, as a society, everyone's addicted. So if you then have an addictive or obsessive disorder, like you're literally, it is, I think I just had to have a word with myself a few days ago and go, oh my God, you need to do something about this, because this is, otherwise you're just going to be on WhatsApp all the time. You're going to be the lady who WhatsApps
all the time.
In Covent Garden, everyone will go and see the lady who's sitting on WhatsApp. No, they won't. That wouldn't make any money, would it?
Yeah, that's just what everyone does, just sits on social media.
But you know what I mean.
I think that's one of the good things about having OCD, is that you can recognise these, you know, behaviours that aren't good for you, because we have rituals that aren't good for us. That's like, so I could definitely recognise my procrastination, laziness, whatever you want to call it, as well now, more than probably some of my other friends would, because, you know, we've had coping mechanisms for similar things.
There was something that you talk about as well in your podcast, which I found really interesting. My favourite word, fascinating.
Fascinating.
There was something in your podcast that I found really fascinating, which was really insightful thing that you said, actually, and that had never occurred to me. It was about relationships and emotionally abusive relationships, or that kind of thing, and how somebody with a mental health disorder might be more vulnerable to those nasty things, that to not recognizing somebody saying nasty things to them, because they say those nasty things to themselves all the time anyway.
I think that there is, like, this, you know, we're used to treating ourselves really badly, so we accept sort of similar treatment from other people. And there does have to be this sort of, like, shift in the way that we treat ourselves if we do want to be treated better by other people. You know, your relationship with yourself is, you know, reflects into every single other relationship you have.
Yeah.
And I think if you're, you know, doing something that's bad for you, or, you know, in contact with someone that's bad for you, it does normally, you know, reflect that relationship that you have with yourself. So I was in quite an emotionally abusive sort of relationship type thing with someone like a year or so ago, and I do think that it was because I was, you know, afraid of my emotions, and I didn't want to have to think about, you know, scary stuff in the future, so you just go and do this really toxic thing, hang out with this really toxic person for you, and it, you know, it distracts you from the actual fear by giving you a different toxic thing to focus on, if that makes sense.
I think that's incredibly relatable, and just something that I had never thought about before, so thank you for kind of wording that. I think it's something that a lot of people will be able to relate to, the fact that when you're, like, if you are so used to those nasty thoughts in your head, and you're not being self-compassionate, and you're not being kind to yourself, and looking after yourself, like,
you're going to seek external validation more.
Yeah, and it might not come from the right place.
Yeah, exactly. This massively changed for me in summer when, I'm going to shout out another book. Basically, I don't know if you know Florence Given. Her book massively,
like, I haven't read it. What's it called?
It's called Women Don't Owe You Pretty. It's amazing. It's it just changed my whole, like, view on calling stuff out, on you know, calling out people for treating you badly, and not feeling bad about it. And I do think, because we are more inclined to external validation when we do, you know, when we do accept this treatment from other people, it does also affect our relationship with ourselves. It's like this, you know, twofold thing that they both are intrinsically linked, our relationship with other people and our relationship with ourselves, and they both affect each other. So if you don't accept some treatment from other people, you're not going to accept it when you talk to yourself like that as well.
Yeah, I've got a book that you might enjoy on a similar vein, which is The Unexpected Joy of Being Single. Whether you're single or in a relationship or whatever, it doesn't matter, like, because it's just about, it's about your respect for yourself and your self-esteem and not needing that outside thing to rely on, and learning that you can, this is what sounds so ridiculous to be relating this to WhatsApp, but this is what I'm proving to myself through my WhatsApp ban, is that I, when I get that urge to like need reassurance from someone, I'm not able to do it.
Almost.
Yeah, and I'm not doing it. And then therefore, when I'm, once I'm through that, I'm kind of going, oh, I did that on my own. Or like, I managed to go and do something different. I didn't engage with that.
It's also the kind of similar vein to Everything I Know About Love by Dolly Alderton.
Great book.
Oh my God.
Such a great book. I mean, again, it's the whole thing of
it's
like
a wonderful book.
Learning to love herself and realising that that is the most important love.
I think when I was 22, a girl that I worked with, who I'm no longer in contact with, but I still have this little post-it note that she gave me. It was in the shape of a heart. And I'd just gone through a breakup and I was like really sad. And she gave me this post-it note and it just said, I should really know it. Otherwise this story is not good. It was something like, learning to love yourself is the beginning of a lifelong romance.
Did that used to be on your wall?
It used to be on my wall. I think it's now in my bedside drawer, but I will keep it forever because it is true. And it sounds like you're being wanky and it can sound very like, cliche, like, you got to love yourself. But like all these things do help, and they help with, I can understand as well, someone might listen to this and be like, I'm here to get my OCD better, not to learn to love myself. Like, but
it's a starting place for everything.
Yeah.
And also your OCD is an aspect of like yourself. Like, it's going to be with you for a long time. You may as well mend that relationship that you have with it. Mm. Because in mending the relationship you have with your OCD, you are going to mend the relationship you have with other aspects of your life and the way you talk to yourself as well.
Yeah, so true. And sometimes when I'm obsessing about something, if I think, sometimes what helps me is when I suddenly get that moment of clarity. I've had to have it so many times with so many different themes of OCD, where I go, oh, hang on a minute, whether my thing I'm scared of is true or not, I have OCD either way, so I should probably deal with that and focus on getting better from that. Either way, I'm still going to have OCD.
Yeah.
So I may as well like work on that rather than obsessing over something else.
Over something that you probably don't have. Yeah, yeah. I know exactly what you mean.
Yeah.
I'm literally there like every night, like, have I got this?
For somebody that might be in the position that you were in a year ago with that person where you kind of felt it was a toxic situation, if there's somebody listening that's in those shoes a year ago, like, what would you say to yourself a year ago?
I'd probably just be like, why are you accepting this treatment when you wouldn't accept it? You would never accept someone else to, like, someone else that you didn't have these feelings for to talk to you like this, or, you know, and if you're embarrassed to tell your friends about stuff they've done, it's a bit of a red flag. and like, you know, trust your friends' reactions.
Yeah.
Because they have an objective view rather than you've got a subjective view.
And don't beat yourself up either for being in that.
No, oh my God, I beat myself up for staying in that sort of place for ages, and then I was like, well, it's not my fault that I was being manipulated, is it?
I feel like we've probably knackered you out with all our questions.
What about the question?
The question. You ask it.
Oh, okay. If you had a magic wand and you could wave it and get rid of your OCD, would you?
So you'd never had it?
I don't think I would. I think my therapist has asked me this before.
Really?
I think it, you know, reminds me of what's important in life. And it gives me perspective, like, when everyone's stressing about, oh, what if someone else wears the same thing as me? What if someone else, you know, like, these sort of trivial things to stress about, which obviously are real stresses for some people. I think it does give me perspective, and I think it does, you know, it helps me relate to other people that have similar struggles, and I understand my brain way more than I would if I hadn't had OCD, because I would never have had therapy. And you know, and I think, you know, my OCD has been a positive influence on my life as well as a negative influence on my life, and it is that recognition of that that will start to help, you know, in your recovery, in your, you know, living alongside your OCD, not seeing it as an enemy anymore. And I think I see it more as a friend now, but just sometimes one that's a bit
misguided,
a bit clingy. Yeah, a bit of a clingy friend.
Yeah. Oh, I love that answer.
I'm enjoying everyone's answers to that question.
Yeah, it makes you feel quite kind of optimistic.
It also makes you feel a little bit like, oh, I'm part of that club.
Yeah, like, oh, that's, I'm in that club. I'm in the cool club.
Thank you so much for listening to today's episode with the amazing Olivia. I was going to say, you can check her out on Instagram.
You can.
At live.ing with OCD.
Which I realised is living, live, because her name is Olivia, with OCD. So it's like living with
OCD.
It
took Beth however many months we've been following her on Instagram to get this.
I've worked it out today.
It took her till today to work that out.
Please do check out OCD Action and OCD UK for support. We've linked both in our show notes below.
As always, you can find us on Twitter at RepeatPod1.
Follow us.
And Instagram at OnRepeatPodcast.
Please follow us.
You can also email us your stories and feedback on repeatpod@gmail.com.
Email us your stories and feedback.
who are you meant to be? Like,
I don't know. The podcast elf.
Okay.
Please do rate, review, and subscribe to the podcast, because, as all the other podcasts that I listen to always say at the end, apparently helps other people find us.
Great.
Bye!
Bye!